Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Om, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording of Rabbi Adam Klickfeld's weekly Rashi study class.
Hello to anyone who's listening to this on the Temple Beth Om podcast series asynchronously. How's the sound compared to last week? Are we good over there, Larry Dayan?
Fantastic.
Fantastic. Okay. Last week.
Yeah.
Last week was a bit of a debacle. Okay. We are on chapter 9 of the book of Exodus. We read verse 23, upon which there's no Rashi. I want to read it again because there's a sforno that I want to share with you, this kind of new-ish custom ritual that if Rashi's silent, rather than just go to the next verse, we see if there's at least one other commentator who can deepen our understanding of the verse. So let's read the verse again, verse 23. So we're still in the plague of Barad, of hail. Vayet Moshet Matehu. Moses extended his staff. Al Hashemayim. That funny phrase that on the heavens, right? Remember Rashi's image of him having been lifted up, so he was kind of extending it downwards to the heavens as if he was, Dumbledore up in the heavens and coming down onto it. Varanai Natan Kolotu Varad, God gave, presented, interesting verb, Natan, thunder and lightning and hail. Vati Halach Esh, we discussed the interesting formation of that verb. Most people understand it as a passive kal verb, that fire went, artsa, to the ground. Vayamter Adonai Barad al Eretz Yisrael. And God rained down hail upon the land of Egypt. Okay? So that was the verse. Rashi had done a lot on the previous verse, because the previous verse basically had said this was about to happen, and then it happened. But he was quiet in this verse. Before we look at any commentators, anybody have any lingering questions or comments on that verse before I pull up a sforno?
23.
No? Okay.
We already covered that last week.
Yeah, I was wondering if anyone had any lingering thoughts on it. Okay. So let's look at verse. Let's look at sforno. I'll put up on the screen. Elon, do your thing if you don't mind. So sforno comments on this notion of vatihalach eish artsa, that the fire went down to the ground. Look what he says. It's there in Hebrew and English. I'll read the Hebrew. Ki ha'avir hanilhav, there. And remember, he's 15th century or 16th century. So his understanding of like meteorological science is not what ours is, but he didn't know nothing. The air, Hanilhav, that had been heated up, Yarad La'aretz, came down to the ground. If you know a little bit about the atmosphere, what's strange about that? Hot air rises, right? So Sforno notices something going on here, that the fire came down. He knows enough to know that fire goes up. Right, that something which is hot goes high, something higher than that which is cold. Bechozek tnuat habarad, in the force of the movement of the hail. So he's imagining that how could it be that hot air came down? It's almost as if he imagines the hail pressing upon the air, right? Which is counternatural, right? Habarad hamachbid alav, the hail that was being heavy upon it. That's the root kaved, heavy in the hefil, that was weighing down. Thank you, weighing on it. Birito lamata, in its descent downward. So he's pointing out. Rashi is going to say something a little bit similar in the next verse in terms of there being like miracles upon miracles or strangeness connected to strangeness. Right? Just the notion of this overwhelming barad is strange, unexpected, hard to explain by natural forces in the realm of miracle. And Sforno notices that even within the barad, you have something that it shows God undoing the natural way of things. Natural way of things, yeah, hail goes down, fire goes up, right? Or heat goes up. And this plague, the heat and the hail came down at the same time. Okay, I thought that was worth sharing. Yes, Rachel, let's give Rachel a microphone. Let's give Rachel a microphone.
This, to me, is just a super clear example of lightning. And how do we know?
A little farther away from you.
Okay,
now.
Sorry.
How do we know?
Sorry about that. My school teacher voice.
Yeah.
How do we know it's not lightning? that we're not talking about lightning in this verse, the fire that came down to earth.
We don't. Sforno is choosing to read. Sforno is choosing to read Kolot as one thing, and Tihalach Eish Arts another thing. So Kolot seems like a thunderbolt, which is a natural way for heat to come down, but he's reading it as, right, Vayet Moshe Mateo al Shamayim, Moses extended his staff upon the heavens, Varonai Natan Kolot Varad, God brought down lightning and hail, and Vatialech Eish Arsa, and the other, and somehow in addition to that, hot air, hot fire air was coming down to the ground. You could read Vatihalech Eish Arsa as just an explanation of the kolot. He's choosing not to.
The kolot is not.
What's that? Matt, microphone.
He's choosing not to. Isn't kolot a reference to thunder?
Yeah.
Sure. Right. Do we
well,
know 100?
It's sound.
Yeah. We don't know for sure, right? But yes, the kolot is sound. Remember from the Exodus, from the Sinai moment, Vayar Takolot, right? That they saw the kolot. So there's either an explanation of the verse that says that this was some kind of a miraculous version of thunder you could hear, or kolot doesn't only mean thunder. Yeah, Sue, microphone.
We have a word for thunder. So it doesn't, we have thunder. It's not that thunder hasn't happened before. We don't have a word in the Torah for thunder. So it doesn't say thunder. It doesn't say thunder. I'm sorry.
Lightning.
Lightning. I meant lightning everywhere you heard lightning. I meant. We have a word for lightning. So it doesn't say lightning. It talks about these, you know, fireballs.
Yeah. Do we have a word for lightning that already appeared in the Torah? Barak? I'm not sure.
I don't think.
Not sure. You know, it's the ongoing wonderful challenge of trying to figure out what words mean from the first source in which they appear, right? Or from the first extant source that appears, right? So we take the fully scholarly approach to this. We don't have a text in biblical Hebrew older than this. So we can't go backwards, right? This is the Ur text. And so, yes, the way it's come down is that kolot seems like something which is auditory, and therefore it's something that you should be able to hear. But the Torah uses these, not necessarily use them interchangeably. We don't have 100% precision on what these nouns mean. I see Rick's hands up, and then I see Rebecca's hand up.
Hi, just a question. Could we look up Arad in your many dictionaries or kolot and see if that'll help with whether it's lightning or hail or thunder?
Okay, so Rick wants us to look up the word in the dictionary. While we're doing so.
Just curious about it. We're asking about the word lightning. I don't remember seeing it.
Right.
The kolot is the thunder, like Kol HaShofar, which I'm very aware of, but I don't know about lightning.
Yeah,
lightning only appears in Samuel and Psalms.
Yeah, that's the word.
What's the word for it?
Barak.
Barak. Yeah. That
Barak. Yeah. Yeah.
That word only appears in Samuel and Psalms twice in Psalms.
Yeah. Right, and our image of the Sinai moment is an image of thunder and lightning, but not because it says that, right? It's from the phrase Vayar et HaKolot, that the people saw the kolot, and how do you try to understand seeing something that is auditory, right? And it's a version of, well, it's in the category of the Sinai moment, which we will get to eventually in this class, being like an inversion and a remixture of things that God divided at creation, right? That sound and sight kind of recombined into one thing. It was such a cataclysmic moment. That's basically the second time God breaks through from God's realm into our realm, and it's as if the world is being created again, right? That's why that moment is so significant for the Jewish people. Rebecca, and then I see.
So in the previous verses 19 and 22, God says he's going to send hail. But then in verse 23, he adds two more elements to it. He sends thunder and hail and fire, which could be the lightning. Right. So he's just, you know, there's three different things, thunder, hail, and lightning, although he said only hail was coming.
Yeah, we didn't have a preview as to all the things that are happening in verse 24. They're just, sorry, verse 23, they're just there, even though God didn't say they were coming. Rosemary?
As we are in miracles, probably the hail and the fire together, it's a sign of miracle, because if the fire comes on hail, hail is going to melt.
Ah, but so hold that thought till we get to Rashi's next verse. He's exactly right. So that's Rashi's version of Sforno's commentary, that there's something not only miraculous, but miraculously miraculous, or not just strange, unexpected, but strangely and unexpectedly unexpected. Very good. So Rashi is going to say that, but he says on the next verse. I wanted to show you one more commentary from verse 24, Hamek Davar. Let me pull it up. This is from the Netziv, Rabbi Neftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin in Volozhin, late 19th. I think he lived into the early 20th century. He was, you know, one of the great Rosh Yeshivas of the Lithuanian non-Hasidic yeshivot in Eastern Europe. He says two things. We're looking at the first one. Vayet Moshe et Maitehu. I think someone hinted at this problem or this curiosity in the verse last week. I don't remember. Afal Gav Sha'amar Hashem Yadcha. Even though God had said, your hand, what does he mean? Look at verse 22. It says, Vayomer Adonai Moshe, God said to Moses, Nate et Yadcha, extend your hand. Right? The specific instruction for this plague was extend your hand. So the Hamek Davar says, even though God had said, quote, your hand, velo hiskir hamateh, and at least in this verse, God did not say anything about a staff. Hevin Moshe. Moses understands God's, you know, informal talk. Shekach dat Hashem. That God said hand, but God really wanted staff. Sharei kfar amar Adonai l'Moshe. God had already said to Moses, Asher b'mateh hazeh yaseh et ha'otot eila, that it's through this staff that you're going to do these signs. Pirush, nete yadcha b'mateh, meaning extend your hand with the staff. And even if God speaks in slightly clipped language and says, extend your hand, Moses and God are so close that Moses knows, no, this means staff. Ma she'en kein, which is not the case, la'aharon. Regarding Aaron, who tzrach Adonai lefareish nete yadcha b'matecha, that every time God is speaking to Aaron in the 10 plagues, Aaron is close to God, but not as close to God as Moses, and God has to be explicit. Moses and God are speaking kind of inside language, right? They have colloquialisms that they understand with each other. So it's an interesting, very, very close read. You could read this, by the way, the opposite. You could say this is showing how occasionally Moses doesn't do exactly what God asked him to do, which is going to happen later on with hands and things. He's right. Someone, that's where it came up last week, where he, you know, we know with the rock, he's told to speak to it and he hits it. That shows a rebellious streak in Moses. Here, the Netziv is reading it as an intimacy, right? They know each other so well, they have pillow talk with each other. And God doesn't have to be explicitly clear as to what God wants. God knows that Moses knows that when God says this, God means that. I thought that was an interesting read as well. Matt, microphone.
Just a last thought on the lightning question. Maybe in this ancient,
3 inches closer.
Maybe in this ancient Hebrew that we're reading here, they didn't really have a word for lightning, because so the phenomenon of thunder and lightning was contained in one word. So that would indicate that the H here would refer to lightning, which can go down, right?
Right, it does go down.
Goes down, goes up. It's confusing to watch videos of it.
It only goes down. It's electricity being discharged from the atmosphere to the ground.
Exactly. So maybe my theory is they don't have a word to separate that phenomenon.
Yeah, it could be. Joanna? Oh, you got to unmute, Joanna.
In Exodus 19, at Sinai, we see Kolot Uvrakim. So it would seem that we do know the word if, you know, if the text had wanted to use it.
She said Brakim comes in
in 1916.
Maybe just in the singular, Matt, it's only later on. Yes, Kolot Uvrakim is almost certainly in. What's the pasuk, Joanna?
19, chapter 19, verse 16.
19:16?
Yes.
Yeah, so if you look at, look ahead, chapter 19, verse 16, Vayihi bayom ha-shlishi, it wasn't the third day, biyot ha-boker, in the morning, Vayihi kolot uvrakim. There was kolot and brakim, which we normally translate here as thunder and lightning, va'anan kaved alahar, and a heavy cloud on the heavens. So, right, so it does seem that if the Torah wanted to use the word barak, the Torah could have. Here the Torah does not use barak, which makes us think that whatever the kolot is, it's not lightning, right? Which gives more fodder to the explanations that something super miraculous is going on. This is not just the natural descent of something fiery from the heavens. Leonard?
I'm looking at a Christian source online here, which is looking at the Bible in English.
Yeah.
And it finds 42 verses about lightning in 15 different books, almost all of them in the Old Testament. Hmm. The first one that it mentions is our verse.
Huh. Wow. So referencing this verse as specifically a reference to lightning.
Right. It translates it as Moses stretched forth his rod toward the heavens and the Lord sent thunder, hail, and lightning flash down to the earth.
Right. So so that is reading the kolot as thunder and the vatihalach esh as the lightning. Yeah. I don't think we actually compare translations of this verse. Hold on a second. This is 923. Let's share the screen. Let's do a few of the translations, and then we'll see if any of the translations that Larry has are interesting. So this, let's start with JPS. Okay, JPS. Oops. Sorry. JPS is, so Moses held out his rod toward the sky, and Adonai sent thunder, kolot, and hail, barad, and fire streamed down to the ground. So it's a straight translation, which may or may not be reading it as lightning, but doesn't use the word lightning, okay? Everett Fox. Moses stretched out his staff toward the heavens, and God gave forth thunder sounds. I like that, because he's using the word kolot, thunder sounds, great, and hail. And also fire went toward the earth. So it doesn't use the vocabulary word lightning, just translates Vatialach Esh Arza. Korin. And Moshe stretched out his rod towards heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail. Okay, so literally translating kolot as thunder, and the fire ran down upon the ground. Larry, does Arye Kaplan or Alter have any interesting translation of this verse?
They do. Kaplan. Moses pointed his staff at the sky, and God caused it to thunder and hail, with lightning striking the ground.
Mm. Interesting. So Arye Kaplan reads as lightning, which means he would dispute some of these medieval commentaries who are reading this fire stuff as something doubly unnatural, right? Lightning is natural. Lightning being brought down at this exact moment is miraculous, but he's going to read against the double miraculousness of it. Yeah. Rick, I see your hand.
Can I read you Alter?
Please.
And Moses stretched out his staff over the heavens, and the Lord let loose thunder and hail, and fire went along earthward.
Yeah, very similar to other translations.
And Alter actually has a commentary on it, which I don't think particularly helps us, but I'll read it if you want.
Sure. I always like reading not particularly helpful comments.
No, it's interesting, but not. I don't think it's directly to this point. The dramatic nature of this plague is another manifestation of the pattern of intensification. Instead of disaster welling up from the Nile or somehow coming through the air, it appears here as a direct and violent assault from above against the land of Egypt. In biblical poetry, as in its Canaanite antecedents, thunder and lightning are the characteristic weapons of the sky god. Mm. The raining down of celestial fire also sets up an elusive correspondence with the story of the destruction of Sodom.
Mm.
And then he comments on his,
that's interesting.
His translation.
Right, just by what the sky looked like connects Egypt and its vile nature to the vileness of stone that had to be destroyed. That's very interesting. Keep going.
And then his translation of went along earthward, he says, instead of the standard form for the Hebrew verb to go, telech, the writer uses a dialectic variant form, tehalach, rarely employed in the Bible and perhaps felt to be archaic as a kind of epic gesture. Went along earthward seeks to produce an equivalent strangeness of effect while replacing the rhyme of the Hebrew.
That's like an intentionally odd use of that verb.
Right.
That's interesting, so right? Because
in a sense, maybe emphasizing that it wasn't lightning, it was fire.
Yeah. Great, right? So it's imagine in the language, in the era of the Torah, when this kind of stilted Hebrew felt normal, this was an intentionally stilted use of a verb to show, something yet more out of the ordinary of this verse. Great. Hello. Rick, Renee, Stevie, Rebecca.
Along those fiery lines, only because Joanna brought it up, but if you go back to chapter 19, there God rides the fire down. He's like the silver surfer. It's Asher Yarad Alav Adonai Ba'esh. So there he's actually coming down on the fire.
What verse?
18.
19:18.
Chapter 19:18. Yeah, a little bit farther from where we were. But there the fire is like an act. And then you have the Eshen HaKiv Shan. It's like the smoke of a furnace. But Asher Yarad Alav Adonai Ba'esh.
Yeah.
There, but not here.
Very so Greek. Very Greek Gaudi.
Yes. Over there, but not here.
Yeah.
Here he just sends it down, right?
Renee and then Stevie.
I just wanted to read you the Saperstein translation. Is Moses stretched out his staff toward heaven, and Hashem sent thunder and hail, and fire went earthward, and Hashem rained hail on the land of Egypt.
Got it. Okay, so very similar to other translations, leaving open the possibility that the fire here is not thunder. Not lightning. Stevie?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that a lot of the motivation to make it supernatural as opposed to lightning, I think, comes from the next verse, not just the Esh B'tocha Barad, which, you know, Rashi and the Midrash are going to pick up on, but that Lo Haya Kamo B'chol Eretz Yisrael Me'asai Delagot, like, if this never happened before, then it's not a normal phenomenon, right? Like, obviously, that could mean just more intense or more extreme or whatever, but I think that's a major source of motivation to, you know, miraculousify this verse in many of the translations that we're reading.
I think that's apt. That will make more sense in about 4 minutes when we read verse 24, that there's something happened in this plague that's not just tremendous destruction brought by God, but a undoing or a redoing or a changing of the natural order, which makes the average Egyptian and hopefully Pharaoh quake even more. That this is not just we're defenseless, but nothing that we knew or relied upon is predictable anymore. Rebecca, Barry, and then Toba.
In Safari, I clicked on the word Aish, and so the BDB shows one of the definitions for some places in the Bible, not this verse, but it's interesting, as God's anger. So, you know, if we can read it like that, that sent thunder and hail, you know, and God's anger came down to the earth.
Hmm. That's great. That's good. Barry?
So lightning is a pinpointing, but this is like fire that engulfs the earth. So there's so much destruction, all the vegetation, all the animals, all people. So this is not pinpointing lightning. It's total destructive fire.
Tova?
All right, just very quickly, this whole discussion, starting with the translations from Christian sources as lightning, just irresistibly reminded me of an experience I had a number of years ago in a history class where the teacher had been talking about the advent of the Bible and had written three different translations on the board of Bereshit Bara Elohim, you know, the first, and there were a number of young women from very conservative fundamentalist colleges from the, in the middle, in Midwest who were in the class. And I just remember one of them frowning at them and finally raising her hand and saying, "But which one is the right one?"
Yeah. With, you know, absent the Midrashic tradition, there is like a feverishness to get the right answer. I'm sure I've told the story before, but since there are sufficiently new faces in the room, it permits me to tell it again. I don't know, my second or third year in the rabbinate, I went to a training in Minnesota with Peter Pitzley, who was the founder of the form called Bibliodrama, where you create a in real time Midrashic experience by placing characters into the story. And it was interfaith. It was interfaith bibliodrama training, because he was saying, you know, a catechism teacher should be able to use this to, you know, add texture and layers to his or her teaching of the Christian tradition, whether it's the New Testament, Old Testament, even though he came to it from the Jewish perspective. And I think it was like 2-1, the number of Christian present students and Jewish students. The Jewish students, I and a few others, presented several different denominations of Judaism. There was an Orthodox day school teacher who came, which I thought was fascinating, a couple of former rabbis. We all had instant facility, even though it was like 1/8 of a second of awkward when Peter would say, "Okay, you know, you are Miriam, and you are waiting in the rushes, and you're looking through, and you see your son going down, your brother going down the Nile. What do you feel right now?" We all got there. Even, you know, it didn't take us long to jump into the painting. The Christian teachers couldn't do it originally. They, when, you know, particularly when they were asked, like, you know, "You're Jesus, you're on the mount, and you're about to give your speech. What do you say?" And the director, Peter, would say, "You are Jesus. What do you say?" They'd say, "Well, what does it say in the book of John?" Right? Like, "Well, how can I be Jesus?" No, "You are Jesus. What do you feel? How can I be Jesus?" They resisted the idea that there was anything in the text besides what the text was, right? And in our tradition, and it's not better or worse, it's just a different way of understanding, different intellectual and spiritual approach to sacred text, we have inherited this Midrashic flexibility that allows us to be playful, sometimes a little bit transgressive, to seek the contours, the crevices that are not apparent. I'm grateful for it. I suppose if I was brought up in a different tradition, I'd be grateful for that. But I'm so grateful for this, right? We don't know what this verse means. That's wonderful, right? On some level, that's wonderful. It's a source of consternation, and we want to figure out how to live our Jewish lives as a result of it. We're a narrative, right? This entire class that I've been teaching for 23 years, it's all narrative, right? We're going to eventually get to laws, right? Not that far away. Parshat Mishpatim is not that far away from us, right? And that's going to be a very different experience, because a lot of the stuff that Midrash is going to bring is not from Midrash Agadah, right? Expanding the stories, but Midrash Halacha, from which we derive Jewish law. That's going to be a very different set of conversations, hopefully equally interesting when we get there in a decade.
I should live so long.
Amen. See, how long is my contract for? Okay, Diane and Larry, would you hand up again?
Yes, it was. So if we're done talking about lightning for a second,
yeah,
and we're about to transition to verse 24 and 25.
Which we haven't read yet.
Haven't read those yet.
No, I have. I know we're transitioning.
Transitioning, okay.
Well, but it's something that applies to all three of the verses. I don't know how people relate to the concept of hell.
Hell.
Barad.
Okay.
The Barad part. In Michigan, we had hell.
Go ahead.
In Michigan, we had hell, and it was basically small pellets. But my sons and I had an experience in the Sinai in whatever year the Atlantic Olympics were, because I remember it was that year, where we were hiking in the Sinai with a Bedouin guide. It was very hot, very, very hot during all the days we were hiking, well into the 100s and above. All of a sudden, and the skies were clear as can be, all of a sudden one day clouds formed and we had lightning and hail. And the hail wasn't the hail of pellets. It was literally the hail of what they call golf ball size and larger. So large that we actually feared for being injured, and we had to take shelter, which was hard to do at the time. And there was lightning coming through this large hail. Now, I don't know if that is typical in the Sinai and in Egypt and even in Israel, although I have been in a couple of other places where you get large hail. But I'm simply saying this, I think, is a natural phenomenon that's relatively common, but it's also very frightening.
Yeah. I experienced the largest hail I ever experienced was also in the summer, not the winter. When we were driving cross country to move to this job, we were pulling into a town called Sterling, Colorado, and we were about 5 miles away from the hotel, and all of a sudden the skies opened up and we felt a pounding on the car. We were concerned it was going to dent the car, could break the window, and I remember you had to park the car, and it was like the covering over which you parked the car was somehow 10 feet away from the opening of the hotel, and it was like perilous to run from the car into the hotel to check in. I'd never seen, we saw hail all the time in Connecticut growing up, but not like that. Not summer hail, not that big. You know, such that you were concerned about it, you know, smashing your head in. Yeah.
You take that as a sign? And,
Matt asked, did I take that as a sign? If I took it as a sign, I didn't listen to it. How about that? All right, let's read verse 24. Because that's the first, we're finally getting a new verse. Joel, I haven't heard from you today. Want to read?
Vayhi barad v'esh mitlakachat betoch habarad kaved me'od asher lo haya kamohu b'chol eretz Mitzrayim me'az hayta legoy.
Good. Most interesting word in the verse is?
Goy.
Okay, well, I was going to say mit lakachat, we'll leave it as a tegu. Let's try to translate.
And there was hail and fire. So go ahead, what's mit lakachat?
Well, what's the root?
Lakach.
Lakach, which means?
To take.
So lehit lakeach, if you put lakach in the hit ba'el, into reflexive, it's to take oneself. So there's a lot of questions here. Mit lakachat is it singular or plural?
Singular.
It's singular feminine. So whatever is doing the mit lakachating, it's a single feminine noun, right?
So vayihi barad, comma ve'esh mit lakachat betoch barad.
Something like that, right? Okay. Esh is a feminine noun, like ve'esh zara, the strange fire that Nadav and Avihu brought into the temple. It's zara. Barad is masculine because it's vayehi, not vatehi. So exactly, and the trup helps you, right? Vayehi varad. So the hail was ve'esh, and the fire mit lakachat betocha barad was taking itself within the hail, something like that, right? But it's we still don't understand what it means, but we now understand what it means grammatically. Keep going.
Kaved me'od, very heavy. Asher lo haya, and that was not. There was nothing like it in the entire land of Egypt from the time it became a nation.
Very good. Goy here is just a plain noun, right? There's nothing pejorative about this. The Torah didn't know of goy as a pejorative. It's just the word for a nation. You could use the word You could use the word goy, right? All right. Questions, comments on the verse, Matt. And then Ilan.
I looked up the word mitlakachat in Morphix, which is an online dictionary.
Yep.
And it says caught fire.
That the verb itself means catch fire?
Yeah. Huh. It could be that became the meaning of it later because of this verse.
Right.
It also, mitlakach sounds to me like it's a reflexive gathering into itself or taking into itself.
Taking to itself, yeah. Some kind of an admixture. Well, who else was hands up? Sue? Leonard? Ilan. But I want to look up a lakach in BDB while we're doing that. Okay, go ahead, Ilan.
Yeah, I'm just curious as to why it's necessary to say from the time it became a nation. What's
What's the significance of that? Why not just say it had never been in the entire land of Egypt? Is the implication that before it became a nation, they had seen it, or is there something else?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the classic commentators are quiet on that. Rashi only comments on Mi'lakachat. This phrase, Me'az Haitala Goy, it almost, I don't know how to say this, almost comes in as like Torah breaking from mythos into its own attempted history. Right, like you know, we know that the Egyptian people were, you know, before they were this, there was something else, and describing an era that the Egyptian monarchy existed, and why it's there, we don't need it, right? The phrase L'hayach Hamoho B'chol Eretz Mitzrayim is enough to say that it's unique, and as Ilan says, do those last three words suggest that? It doesn't make sense to say that the Torah was suggesting, before Egypt was a nation, it did happen. It almost seems like an intensifier to explain how rare and unique this is. But why it's there, don't know. Good question. Leonard, Tova, Diane, Larry.
So in my dictionary, it says, for the Hidbael, it took fire, blazed up. So it sounds like this word is only used with Ish.
In the heat pile.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Who is next? Tova?
On the Me'az Haitala Goy, I'm thinking that in the Egyptian mind, the unification of the two lands of Upper and Lower Egypt was a moment of creation that was sort of unparalleled to the creation of the world itself. The world itself, you're taking chaos and creating order, or ma'at, and the uniting of the two lands was taking social chaos and creating order. And so this is like saying this moment of these out of control, chaotic things happening was like before the uniting of the two lands. And so it's kind of bringing the chaos almost of creation together with social chaos.
That's fascinating. Before we get to Larry David, I want to show you Larry Diane, not Larry David. Larry David's not in our class.
That would be interesting.
That's a compliment.
Just curb your
My thinking is foggy today. BDB on Hit Pael gives us our verse as an example. So the Hit Pael of Lakach is Eish Milakachat, literally fire taking hold of itself. Now, I don't think that BDB is saying that Lakach in the Hit Pael specifically means to ignite, but it's explaining that what is the fire doing? It is taking hold of itself. What that means is another question. Exact significance, I forgot what DUB stands for here. In close succession, incessant, enfolding itself like a mass of fire, quivering flashes, forked or zigzag lightning.
Dubious.
That's what it means in BDB, dubious?
Well, I don't know BDB, but I'm guessing that's what it means.
Okay. Okay, Larry and Diane.
So Aryeh Kaplan is going to help us out a lot. He doesn't have very many commentaries. He has very brief comments, and they're always related to the other commentators. But his translation first here is: there was hail with lightning flashing among the hail stones. It was extreme, period. It was extremely heavy, unlike anything Egypt had experienced since it became a nation. Now, I just want to read before I go back to Kaplan. Alter's translation is completely different. He says, and there was very heavy hail. So the Me'od, Kaved Me'od, which comes after the Etnachta, he puts to the beginning of the verse. Okay. So it's the hail that's very heavy, with fire flashing in the midst of hail, comma, the like of which there had not been in all the land of Egypt from the time it became a nation. So he's making it seem as if this entire phenomenon had never occurred before. If you look at the Etnachta, I'm going to claim that the reading of the Masoretes would have been that it's the heavy hail that had never been seen before, but not this hail with fire. But now going back to Kaplan, he translates it as flashing, which he says is from the Targum, or fire darting, or fire jumping. Those come from Targum Yonatan and the Sechel Tov. Or deadly fire from Shmot Rabbah, or self-contained fire from Hirsch, or, and this is the one I love from Malbim, fire holding itself to the hail. And then he says, see Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 4. The expression can also be translated, lightning flashes in close succession, incessant fire, a mass of fire, or forked fire. Some say it denotes a meteor shower.
His reference to the Targum of as being kind of flashing fire, look at the Unculus, verse 24, Vahava barda ve'eshata, there was barad and eshata is fire, mishtal havat. So Unculus takes the root lakach, which seems plain, just to take, and turns it and renders it in Aramaic using the word that means a flame, shalhevet, right? Mishta. So it flamifies. It's using shalhevet as a verb, as a verbal idea. Mishtal hevet bego barda. It was flashing and torching within the barad. Since then, Alter is basically reading the verse as if it's vayehi barad kaved ma'od, as you said, ve'eshmi lakach betoch barad. Asher lo hayakmo, and that whole combo, as you're saying, is what is completely unique. Yeah. Rick, and then Barry, and then we're going to look at Rashi.
Hi. On the trope, the Zakef Gadol on Ve'esh, it could have been a revia, you know, just a directional, the fire coming down. But the Zakef Gadol, it goes back and forth. I really like that zigzag definition that you found. The way I do it is da 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 da, of course there's variations, but I thought that was interesting. And the kaved me'od, every time I see kaved, I think of the weighing of Pharaoh's heart, and if it's heavy, it's bad, and it's just echoing the other themes.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that the trap on Ba'esh is very. It's an interesting pause, and singing it as in an up. However you sing the Gadol, it's definitely an up down kind of parabolic, a zigzagging parabola,
back and forth. It's a separation, like Lahavdil in the beginning of Genesis. That's where you have the first one to separate the heavens and stuff. So
yeah, thanks, Rick. Barry?
Yeah, moving on in that direction, and Tova, we're the mistake is using human knowledge and our knowledge of nature to describe this. This phenomenon predates the creation. It predates knowledge. It predates the existence of knowledge. You go back to what was it initial before the division? Before the division of up and down, it's so the fire is within the hail. It's all together. It's we don't comprehend it. It's before human comprehension.
And that's a perfect segue to Rashi. So Joel, read Rashi on Mit Lakachat Betoch HaBarad.
Mit Lakachat Betoch HaBarad Gam Betoch. Oh, Nes betoch Nes, Ha'esh v'abarad mu'avin v'abarad mayim hu v'la'asot ratzon konam asu shalom b'nehem.
Okay.
Very nice.
So what's Nes betoch Nes?
A miracle within a miracle.
So the first level of miracle is that God called for it to happen, and it happened exactly at the right moment and came down specifically on the people God wanted to destroy. The miracle within the miracle is what? Sheha'esh.
The fire and the hail combined or intermingled, and the hail was water.
Right. So I would take the vav of v'habarad as a but, right? That the fire and of the second v'habarad, the fire and the hail are mixed. V'habarad mayimhu, but hail is water, right? And what does water normally do to fire?
It extinguishes
it. All right. It they they're they're opposite forces, right? Velasot.
Velasot, Ratzon. And in order to fulfill the desires of Konam, is the creator.
Right, their creator. Kone, we think of as to purchase or to acquire, but it also means, like, Lasot Ritzon Konam means to do the will of their creator. Like, by God having created them, God also kind of acquired them as God's own, right? So that idea is mixed in that root kone.
So even though they're natural enemies, in order to fulfill the creator's will, they made peace between them.
Yeah. What do you all make of this?
What would Arthur make of this?
What's your reaction to that Midrash that he's quoting, and Alan, and then Rosemary?
I find it remarkable. I've never heard anything like this before. You know, in all the times that, you know, we've read this material, to think that, to try and come up with an idea that fire and water, you know, can, I feel like James Taylor, but
fire and rain.
But here that they can coexist is, it strikes me as something most unusual. I would never expect to see the miracle within the miracle itself when talking about the 10 plagues.
Yeah, the Midrash is an attempt at resolving what is it about this plague that gets the added phrase, Asher lo kamohu, right? And so the Midrash is saying, there's got to be something that broke through not just the natural way of things in terms of hail being so predictable and so destructive, but this fire hail working together. And it does it in a way that, yes, presses against our rationality, but we're not in the realm of rationality. We're in the realm of sermonica. And I guess the question I want you to think about is what's the sermon here? Aside from just resolving the problem or the question of fire and hell coming together, what's a so what that could emerge from this reading of this verse? Rosemary, because I have a thought. I want to hear Rosemary first.
I'm just the same way surprised, because the hail is thick, so the fire touches and it becomes water. Mm. But then the water is not able to cover the fire. So that's working all together the same time.
Yeah. And just pause you, the Rashi's use of the word me'orvin is very intentional, because it's the root arev, which means to mix, like the erbuvia that's the word that Rashi uses to describe the light darkness that existed before God split them off in creation, right? So there's something about this verse that is hearkening back to God's original division of things in creation that now God is pushing back together or like undoing creation for the Egyptians, at least, in the same way that God undid creation in the Noah story. And things that ought to be separate are mixed, right? In a way that we can't fathom, just like we can't fathom the pre-creation mixture of light and dark. We can't fathom it, right? But that's how it's being described here. Sorry.
But one more thing, that when we look all the plagues, it's not only, I mean, there's two aims, probably three aims. One is to the Egyptians are afraid, so they will let people go. The second one is to teach Jews to believe in God, because I don't know how much they were believing before. And the third one is for us, because when the hail and fire was falling, people weren't sitting admiring God's miracles. They were afraid. Mm. They were covering. But we have the luxury after years to study and then really have the faith more. So it has meaning of faith for future also.
Great. Stevie?
Yeah, just you're talking about the sort of status of creation here. I just wanted to point out in verse 23, the difference between, right, Natan Kalotu Varad and Aish is like that in many ancient cosmologies, like fire is something that exists in the universe out there. And like, you know, we maybe are sheltered from it through the firmament and only see the stars as like holes in the firmament to see the fire behind them. Generally in the Bible, it's the opposite, that it's water that exists outside the firmament. But nevertheless, like it, the phrasing here of like Natan Kolu Duvarad seems like God is, you know, placing or making available thunder and hail that like aren't normally there, but they're going to be there now. But fire, which is sort of already there, is now going to be running towards the earth. And that the sort of the primordialness or the like the preexistence of some sort of, you know, fire in the abstract that's already out there in the cosmos seems to be part of the play in this this episode.
Yeah. Thank you, Stevie. What did people make of the last phrase that Rashi uses? So he describes that the Barad and the Esh were Moravim, they're mixed together. But wait a second, Barad is water, and we know that water normally extinguishes fire. V'lasot ratzon konam, in order to do the will of their creator, asu shalom b'nehem. What do we think is the... That is not a throwaway line, right? For Rashi to say here that these two antagonists, enemies, if you will, in order to satisfy the will of their creator, made peace between them. What do you think that's doing sermonistically in this comment? I see three hands on Zoom, so I'll start with Diane Larry, then Rick, then Renee.
So there's sort of an image of the, I guess, the end of days, the lion lying down with the lamb.
Hmm. So it seems in that regard sort of pre-messianic, although in the lion lying down with a lamb, it's like they're creating peace with each other here to create non-peace for the Egyptians. Something interesting going on here, right? So how beautiful, fire and water are becoming friends in destruction. Right, raining friendly, cooperative partnership havoc upon the Egyptians. There's an irony, maybe there's even a stronger word, with how God is mustering God's forces peacefully to create absolute mayhem. Right, Rick, and then Renee.
Yeah, hi. In my Silverman, after the piece one with the other, it shows Tanhuma and then comma Exodus Rabbah 12. So I thought that might enlighten us. I don't know. I just thought I'd let you know.
Right.
Exodus Rabbah 12.
Rashi takes this from a Midrash, correct.
Right. But is there anything more there that would help us see what he means by peace? I don't know.
There are
just a question.
Yeah, the longer original versions of the Midrash, which we could look at. I'm wondering mostly how, like, what is the significance of Rashi using that phrase in Rashi's very clipped, terse presentation of words. Renee?
I was going to say something along the lines of what you said. They didn't eat. They each used the power that they had not to extinguish themselves, but to become friends.
Yeah. Listen, I don't know if this is too, you know, modern and liberal in 21st centuries of me to impose back on Rashi and the Midrash before it, but is there some critique going on here that in order to eliminate or at least suppress a tremendous enemy of the Jewish people, like the heavens are modeling a coexistence, right? A moving from antagonism to partnership and peace. Or is it just trying to explain a verse? But the idea that these celestial battlers come together in order to teach this enemy a lesson, is it somehow supposed to show to the people down here, right? Fire and water can work together if they choose to give up on fighting each other. Yeah. Tova?
Kind of a flip of that.
My microphone.
Oh, sorry.
Sort of a flip of that would be the suggestion that the very fact that this brutal antagonism exists is being mirrored in the natural world. Like there's a sort of a reciprocal reflection.
Great. Right, so that is the exact opposite of that read.
Right.
I see Larry Diane, and then we'll close with Rosemary.
I like your interpretation a lot, but I'm going to take Rashi at face value. Rashi is saying to us, Nes betoch Nes, all of the makot were miracles, but in this one there was a miracle within a miracle, and the miracle was not that fire and water would want to coexist. I'm God. I created them to be enemies, for water to put out fire, for fire to evaporate water. But you see, I can even make the things that I've created overcome their natural state that I've created. That's the miracle within the miracle.
Yeah. To be very, very hyper-precise on Rashi, and I forgot exactly how the verbs work in the Midrash, Rashi's saying that they did it, not that God forced them to. La'asot ritzon konam, in order to do what they, the fire and the hail, understood God wanted them to do, asu shalom benehem, right? They overcame their natural tendency to overpower one another rather than God forced them. But it's still this, you know, what you said still holds.
No, you both, maybe both, because they did it to perform the will of their creator.
God, yeah, yeah. Rosemary, you get the last word.
I think the moment we are in danger, we can use the fire, we can use the hail, but Rashi teaches us that in future, even if Egyptians and Israel at that time were in fight, but later on we learn that we can go with peace with each other.
Had I been the rabbi at the Sinai Peace Accords, right, I would have brought this drash, right? But the instinctual enemies finding a way to work together, la sot ritzon konam.
Way to bring up ancient conflicts.
We'll begin here next week. Have a good week, everybody. Rashi is part of the next few verses, so we'll get an array of other commentaries. Rashi does not speak again until verse 28. Bye, everybody.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.